The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. More Premier League and early contenders for goal of the decade. Choudhury, Haller, Yahanbash. It's new manager bounce time. The second coming of Moyes for West Ham over Bournemouth. And the Arteta effect gets into gear with a win over Manchester United. Who put Fred on free kicks? Is the mask of humility slipping for Jose as turgid Spurs lose to Danny Ings on the South Coast? And there are vital wins for Villa and Watford. In the Football League, it's honours evens at the Hawthorns while Ian Holloway gets off to a winning start at Grimsby. We'll round up everything that's happened in the last couple of days, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning.
Happy New Year.
Doodling already. Are you bored already?
No.
Nice to see you.
And you.
Many questions about, so you tweeted out a picture on New Year's Eve of your super soaker, full and ready to spray anyone around the Brixton area, but it was unused.
Yeah, unused. Every New Year's Eve at Brixton Academy, there's a sort of a ravey, disco-y, I don't really call it, dance
for the
night.
Kids. Yeah.
Something for the kids that goes on till 5 a.m. So it's usually quite busy time of year because, I don't know, they must drink a lot of fizzy pop. They're all quite animated when they leave at 5 a.m. And but either they didn't come up my road or I was just in such a deep and tranquil sleep that I didn't wake up.
Elliot Ross, welcome back.
Thanks, Max. Nice to be here.
You are relaunching your podcast, Football is a Country, in the new year.
That's right.
All right.
Later this month.
I'm going to, in part three, ask you all about it.
Okay.
Okay, so be ready for that. The Pod Addict writes, has Philippe Auclair got a new rantometer for the decade, or is his just a timeless one?
Good morning.
Good morning. Do you have a New Year's resolution to swear more? I hope so.
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
I was struggling a bit to find something to rant about, but I found it.
Oh, what is it? Just give us the headline and we'll say that.
World Cup final in Manchester.
There we are. Okay. Well, I look forward to it. Let's begin at the Emirates, shall we? Arsenal 2, Manchester United 0. Mikel Arteta's first win as manager. Arsenal's first win against a team in the top half as it stands. And fully deserved. Philippe, was this a sign of Arteta's genius or a damning indictment of Unai Emery?
I was going to
Solskjaer, yes.
A bit of all three. I was at the game and I must say that was probably the most, from an Arsenal perspective, the most enjoyable game in a long, long time, putting aside the comeback against Tottenham in the Tool at the beginning of the season. But this felt completely different in so many ways. The atmosphere, for starters, was quite electric. And I know that some people will say that if you think of an electric atmosphere at the Emirates, you probably think about an electric blanket. But that was not the case. It was really, you know, cracking and crackling from the first second till the last, as it was against Chelsea, but with the amp cranked up to 11. So that was great. And it seemed to communicate with the players and vice versa. And honestly, the first half they played made you think, well, he's onto something. There is really something happening at the Emirates.
What did he do?
I think it's just a question of more intensity, more aggression, more pressing, but more organized pressing as well. What was really striking as well, I sit very close to the pitch at the Emirates, was to see how the players were constantly talking to each other, including players you're not used to see talking to others, such as Mesut Ozil. More about him in a second. And obviously they were just, I said, let's do this, let's do that. Let's, you know, put into practice what we have rehearsed. And the performance was simply quite superb for 45 minutes. A bit of a wobble, as is the case with Arsenal all the time these days, probably problem of fitness, but finished the game quite well and even drawing some oles from the crowd, which were not oles by the Manchester United supporters, whom I've rarely heard as silent as they were last night.
Their away fans are noisy generally.
They're very, very noisy. They're very good. And this time they felt, no, it's not going to happen.
Barney Ronnie writing, the most surprising thing about Arsenal's attacking plan, Arsenal had an attacking plan. And Elliot, Philippe mentioned Mesut Ozil. And when he's good, just everything about him is so, it's so nice to watch. He's playing at his own pace, but it's working. And every weight of pass is perfect.
Yeah, Ozil was really purring last night, and I had a different view to Philippe. I was up in the gods, so I had a kind of almost like an aerial view of some of the balls he was pinging around. And he seems to he's often criticized for not running around, obviously, enough. And I think he ran a really long way. I think he was the second furthest running player last night. And what strikes me about him is how much he feeds off the kind of collective energy of whichever team he's in. So under Emery, I think what we became used to seeing at the Emirates was players looking a bit nervous and trying to hold a position very firmly that they'd been told to take up within Emery's tactical plan. Very, very different to Wenger, who gave them all this freedom to move around as they like. And I think Arteta's given them a lot more freedom and a lot more clear instruction that they seem to understand about where to go. And that seems to feed back into the other part of Ozil's game, the defensive side. And he recovered, I think, was it 10 recoveries or something, 10 tackles? It can't have been 10
I've never
tackles,
just never he, even sort of think of him as someone.
I think he turned over possession 10 times. And it just made a huge difference, particularly if as Arteta seems prone to do, he's picking like four kind of attackers, one of whom is Ozil, and only two at the base of midfield. You really need Ozil to be doing a job, and last night he did that really, really well.
Nicolas Pepe, a nice quote from him. I had a discussion with the coach this morning. He told me I was going to start and asked if I felt ready and stuff like that. I told him I felt ready. Today is also my mother's birthday. This is a nice piece of extra information. Here's a question, Barry, from Ben. Is Matic, Fred and Lingard the worst midfield United, no, the league, have ever fielded? I mean, United were bad, weren't they? Is it their midfield? Is it all of them? Is it Solskjaer? What is it?
I think there's a lot of blame to go around. Jesse Lingard's decline has been alarming. I know he's had personal issues going on behind the scenes, which I suppose you have to factor in because he's, well, I was going to say he's just a kid, but he's not, is he? He's in his mid-20s now. But, yeah, I'm prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt, but he just isn't good enough to play, I think, in the Premier League at the moment. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer doesn't particularly impress me. And their midfield, they need new recruits. Nemanja Matic, you know what you're going to get with him now, and it's not really good enough. So
Jose will probably swap him with Harry Winks. Imagine.
I thought it was quite striking that Philippe was also at the Chelsea game, I believe. Yeah. And Arsenal's performance in the two games were quite similar, I would say.
Yeah.
Particularly because they're managing so much fatigue and have so many players kind of filling in different positions. But whereas Lampard brought in Jorginho and tweaked his system and made life very, very difficult for Arsenal, it was quite noticeable that in the second half, Solskjaer kind of came out same again. He made changes down the line, but there wasn't a kind of tactical... I mean, Arsenal definitely had weaknesses that could have been addressed.
Do you think that's a weakness of Solskjaer, or the fact that he looked at his bench and went, there isn't anything I can do?
Well, I think he could possibly have brought on Greenwood a bit earlier. Greenwood caused some problems when he came on. The other thing that was really striking was how much they ended up attacking through Wan-Bissaka in the second half. And Wan-Bissaka is an incredible player, particularly to see live. This is my first time seeing him live. It's just an uncanny ability to block everything and tackle everyone who comes within about 10 metres of him. But going forward, he's not that great, and his final ball's not that good. And somehow in the last 20 minutes in particular, United's attacks just kept ending up with him. And Arsenal had Saka at left back and Aubameyang in front of him, which you'd think would present some opportunities to exploit.
The second goal was... an example of how zonal marking just looks, when it doesn't work, it looks so bad. You know, because Lacazette just wanders forward and everyone just goes, well, he's not in my bit anymore, so it's not my problem,
yeah,
and fix it on. Is there anyone here who would support that as a defensive plan?
I think it might be painting the picture with a rather wide brush, Max.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it does work. I mean, actually, most teams use zonal marking with an element of personal marking at
right,
times.
Okay.
Very often the systems are not as clear-cut as, you know, it's not like, oh, this is your man. No, works a bit differently. But on that particular corner kick, the problem was also due to the fact that the Arsenal players, I remember, I mean, looking, it was the only corner kick, by the way, that Arsenal had the whole game.
Oh, really?
Yep. Is to see how they huddled together, a bit like the train, the loft train of England at the World Cup. And somehow Manchester United were not prepared for that. And the delivery was really wicked. And very good delivery in a very cramped space creates havoc. What's new? So I don't think the fact was zonal marking made a big difference to that.
Solskjaer said when he was asked how long Pogba would be out for, he said 3 or 4 weeks maybe, I don't know. He's been advised to have an operation by his people.
And he'll probably do that afterwards.
Who knows? It's interesting that Solskjaer said his people, not our people. I don't know if that's reading too much into it.
Well, people seem to interpret this as a sign of weakness for Manchester United that they're letting Pogba's people call the shots. I don't think it's uncommon for these big name players to have their own personal physicians and whatnot, but I wouldn't read too much into it. I mean, I think Pogba, as far as his Manchester United career is concerned, is a busted flush anyway, and this isn't going to make any difference one way or the other.
You can imagine, I mean, for a world champion to have a blank season, because that's what it's going to be, after you've won the title at the age of 26. I mean, that's catastrophic. I mean, in the scope of his career, this is the moment at which he should be asserting himself as the great midfielder that everybody knows he can be. And then all you hear is stories about what Raiola talks about. He needs a club, structured club like Juventus. And that's all you hear about Pogba, the fact that he's gone to his brother's wedding, or he's gone to celebrate New Year with friends and family, and that's all you hear about him. And this, okay, I suppose it's a paroxysm of what Pogba's career has been, which is you don't talk about the football anymore.
I think the club did clarify that their medical staff supported the whatever diagnosis Solskjaer was talking about on his foot injury. It really struck me last night that Pogba kind of obviously is the player that United really need right now. I mean, they have an excellent defence and an excellent defensive record this season. They have good, young, fast strikers, and they're sort of missing that bit of creativity in midfield.
Surprised that you think they have an excellent defence.
One more goal than Manchester City.
I think of them as a sort of solid but not particularly exciting team, and I think if you add Pogba to that mix with the strikers in front of him, you have something to go on.
You enjoyed the post-match interview, Luiz and Sokratis, Barry.
Yeah, well, they spoke at length about how the fun was back, how it was quite a damning indictment of the Unai Emery regime, and I think it was also quite a damning indictment of the prevailing attitude among Arsenal's players. I mean, they've been commended at great length by their own fans for making a big effort last night. I think the very least that should be expected of a professional athlete is that they make a big effort all the time. Arteta has said that's non-negotiable. You know, he's one of his non-negotiables. But they clearly weren't enjoying things under Unai Emery. He's not a very charismatic man. You know, I've been to some of his press conferences, and if he's as inspirational on the training ground as he is in the media room, God help, you know. But he has had success at Sevilla, so, you know, we'll give him that. They clearly didn't like him. They clearly didn't think they were fit enough, and Arteta said, you know, they're still not fit enough, but that Rome wasn't built in a day. But, yeah, I also thought it was a bit of a damning indictment into the collective attitude of the players.
To St Mary's, Southampton 1, Spurs 0. Danny Ings with a reverse gazza, with Toby Alderweireld playing the Colin Henry role absolutely superbly. And what a season Danny Ings is having. Paddy says, how good is Danny Ings? Is he Champions League quality? Philippe, how good is Danny Ings?
He's not, because if he were, he would have stayed at Liverpool. And he's... I don't want to diminish his, you know, the quality of his football, of his, you know, of his qualities as a footballer. I think he's having one of those seasons that sometimes happens. Ricky Lambert, if I take the case of another Southampton player who was not Champions League material, had one of those, or a couple of those. So it's more a question of somebody who is finally also is injury free, which was not the case for him in the past. And obviously is the just enjoys being the focal point of the attack. And he's a very good footballer. And I don't think there's much more than that to it.
Fine.
I don't think that's being too hard on him.
No, I don't think so. No.
I think it's worth mentioning that he's been scoring consistently while Southampton have been really struggling at points this season. And I think the other thing, I mean, I have a big soft spot for Danny Ings, but I think he's also an interesting illustration of how differently things can go when one of the teams further down the table pick up a sort of squad player. So if you contrast his fortunes this season with, for example, Dominic Solanke at Bournemouth, both players picked up for quite high fees off the back of sort of Liverpool's juggernaut. And Ings is just scoring for fun, and Solanke, has he scored this season?
No, and he had a great chance, didn't he?
Solanke has one senior goal to his name in about 60 senior appearances, and he missed it. Sitter yesterday. He looked like a player who's absolutely bereft of confidence.
Southampton, 3 wins and a draw in their last 4, including wins over Spurs and Chelsea. How much credit should we give Southampton, Barry, for sticking with Hasenhüttl?
They got off to a slow start this season. They've had 2 absolutely shocking performances, one against Leicester where they lost 9-0, one against, I think it was Everton, they were absolutely appalling. So I think people expected Hasenhüttl to be sacked, and at the time, you know, managers have been sacked for less, a lot less, but clearly they decided to bide their time. I don't know if it was because they had faith in his methods or because they didn't have anyone in mind to replace him, and yeah, he's really got the players going again and deserves credit for it, but you know, he deserves criticism as well. Getting beaten 9-0 is bad.
And that's the sort of insight that people keep coming back to Football Weekly for.
You know, he deserved criticism at the time. You know, football moves, things change. But yeah, I was surprised he held on to his job, I must confess.
You have to remember as well that at the beginning of the season, they had loads of injuries at Southampton. I don't think he was able to pick the same defence twice for something like 10 games. They also had a run of absolutely horrible fixtures. I mean, it seemed like every other game was, oh no, not that one. Oh, not that one, particularly at home. So their confidence was bust. They didn't have a defence to rely on. He was playing 3 at the back, he was playing 4 at the back, he was trying 5. He was trying all these things. It wasn't working. But little by little, which is, I think, shows that he's a very decent manager, which we knew, he managed to get over this very rickety period where people were really thinking he should be shown the door. And actually reminded us why he came with such a big reputation and that he was also the guy who saved Southampton from relegation last season.
Spurs weren't particularly good.
They were dreadful.
They weren't great at Norwich, and they got worse. On Match of the Day, they picked out, you know, big players not performing, Vertonghen and Alderweireld looking off the pace. I thought there was an interesting moment where Ndombele gets injured and Jose didn't bring Harry Winks on, right? He's not picked Harry Winks, who is a ball-playing midfielder. He had Eriksen on the pitch already, but he brought Lo Celso on, who is a wonderful footballer, but a different type of footballer. I just wonder what Harry Winks would be thinking about that.
It's all come to pass, isn't it? The people said when you arrived, this is the Eric Dyer's greatest chance and Harry Winks', you know, misfortune. And I think Dyer would have played if he hadn't been ill. I think he was ill for this game. So, yes, it doesn't bode well. It's extraordinary how we seem to have gone to Mourinho third season in the space of 40 days.
Do you think the mask has slipped? He got a yellow card. As he said, the yellow card was fair because I was rude, but I was rude to an idiot. It looked very much like he was just peering at one of the Southampton coaches' notes.
The
goalkeeping coach's notes. I mean, what are you doing? What's he doing?
I think he said he gave him some bad words.
Yeah. But what, I mean, it's ridiculous. And then on Ndombele, he said he's always injured. He's injured. He plays one match. Next week he's injured. It's a concern. He plays very well against Norwich. You're full of hope he's ready for it, but he's not. It's a situation we've had since the beginning of the season.
This doesn't sound good. And I think what must be really frustrating for Spurs fans is they brought in these 2 great midfielders, Ndombele and Lo Celso, and just haven't been able to get them both on the pitch. But they both seem to just be struggling with injury, with fitness. But I can't see that Mourinho kind of hanging Ndombele out to dry like that is going to help much.
Well, it's hard to know. He clearly isn't impressed with Ndombele. I don't know what the injury is. Now, some players are less inclined to play through the pain barrier than others. I don't know if he's one of those or not, but if he is, you can understand Jose Mourinho's frustration, but it's possible he was genuinely hurt and not fit to continue. Was it a dig at his medical staff? He has previous, you know, let's not forget, for not being able to keep the player fit. I don't know, but he's also lost Harry Kane a hamstring injury, which presumably will keep him out for four or five weeks.
Yeah, I think that could be a blessing in disguise for Tottenham.
What, Son coming back?
Kane not in the best of form, giving him a bit of a rest mid-season.
Harry Kane is clearly a wonderful footballer. Does anyone else think, when he gets it in midfield, and he is very creative when he drops deep, it's very rare he tries to assist anyone because he wants to score the goal. So he tries a sort of cleverer or a more difficult pass. He gets caught sometimes because there's a sort of inner centre forward selfishness within him that means he wants to spring someone out wide rather than slipping, say, Ali through, because
he reminds me a little bit in that sense of what happens when great veteran strikers go to like MLS or something. Like, I used to go and see Thierry Henry now and again for the Red Bulls, and he would constantly get exasperated with teammates, drop back into the left back position, and then spray some impossible ball cross field. The other guy I saw doing this recently was actually Kenny Miller at Partick Thistle.
Oh, really?
Yeah, before my last two games that I've been to see have both been Partick Thistle games, and Kenny Miller is still running the show there at the age of 40. Harry Kane probably wouldn't love that comparison.
Edward says, serious question from a Spurs fan. Does the pod think that Ozil would be a good replacement for Eriksen at Spurs?
Yeah.
He's written serious.
Well, Ozil had his best season ever with Real Madrid and Jose Mourinho, didn't he? We'll leave it at that, I think. Yeah.
Could be a swap deal. Might keep everyone happy. Southampton play Huddersfield. Spurs go to Middlesbrough in the FA Cup. Finally, for part one, West Ham 4, Bournemouth 0. West Ham, the highest scoring team of the decade. Producer Jonathan put that in. I read it and went, hang on a second. Oh, okay. Did Moyes do anything different, Barry?
I don't know, because I don't see enough of West Ham to know whether he did a huge amount differently.
You lucky
I know he has said that he had almost no time with the players. He didn't do anything with them on the training ground, not even set pieces. He just sort of had a meeting and told them what he expected of them. So he gave them a pep talk. That clearly helped. I mean, I found his comments at his press conference a bit strange, where he goes boasting about how he's a winner. He wins things.
I've got the quote here, which what anybody is getting with me as an experienced Premier League manager. Arguably, there's only two or three have got more than me. I've got the biggest win rate out of... And then there was a pause, and he said, a certain number of managers as well. Because if you actually look at the win percentages of managers... Quite understandably, David Moyes is not in the top 10.
Yeah,
put it that way, that's what I do. I win.
Yeah, but he doesn't. But I'm, you know, that's
no.
Just...
I mean, I suppose at a press conference, you know, you say things without necessarily totally thinking them through.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't expect him to come out and go, well, I'm a loser. But, yeah, I did. It was a strange thing to say. You could sort of big yourself up in different ways that can't be so easily disproven. I mean, he's never won a trophy. He's... since his time at Everton, he's been bang average at best with various clubs. But I saw someone on Twitter was criticising us for writing him off, saying that he's been educating himself during his time off in the last year and a half, and that may very well be the case. And he was a decent manager at Everton. He is supposed to be a very good coach, but... And he's obviously had an impact there. I suspect that may be more down to the fact that Pellegrini's left than he has arrived. But again, you know, it's a good start, but let's not go mad and read too much into
it. It's also got to do with Bournemouth.
I was going to say, you know, could he have picked a better team to play
Burnley
in his first game in charge of Burnley? Possible. I mean, look, Haller's goal is lovely, probably the third nicest of the decade. Philippe Anderson got his first goal of the season. Mark Noble, his seventh brace in league football, never got a hat-trick. But Bournemouth, what's happening?
And what's happening is that something which... I thought would happen much earlier, and which is also what's happening to Burnley, and it's really not casting, you know, doubt on the abilities of their coaches, but it's going stale. It's basically clubs which are at the absolute in terms of reach, they cannot reach further than what they've done already. They haven't got the means to get bigger or better players. They cannot attract more, you know, more players or more audience or whatever. So you're constantly fighting against this.
And when you get a lot of injuries, which they have had.
Yes. And then after a while, I would imagine that there's a kind of entropy, which sets in the squads and in the clubs, because, you know, both Deitch and Howe have been at their clubs for a very long time. I've done extremely well. But there comes a moment where you've got to ask questions about, well, where do you go? Is there anywhere to go except down?
They've had injuries. They've got, in Callum Wilson, Josh King, strikers who aren't scoring. Dominic Solanke has been given chances. He can't buy a goal for love or money. Their defence is poor. And on the face of what I've seen in so far this season, I would say they'd be my big favourites to get relegated.
And actually, there's a first season where you haven't predicted them to go down at the start of the season. Maybe the season that they did go down. 5 wins in 21, 2 wins since the 20th of September.
That Elliot, sounds like Arsenal form.
It does, doesn't it?
It's wild inconsistency as well in terms of performances. I mean, sometimes from one game out of five, suddenly you think, oh, that's the Bournemouth of 3 seasons ago. And then the next game, you know it's not going to happen.
It's quite a lot of teams like that. I mean, at all levels of Premier League, it's strange.
At the moment, yes.
There was an interesting bit.
West Ham are another one.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course.
You know, you see the West Ham who won at Chelsea, you think, well, how can they be in such trouble? Then you see them the next game and think, well, they're really rubbish.
Yeah. Interesting bit of VAR. Aaron Cresswell getting a straight red from Graham Scott for quite a robust challenge on Ryan Fraser, and VAR decided no serious foul play. If you were in the VAR seat, Elliot?
Did they revise it because he got the ball?
Yes. Well, I think so.
Because my understanding was that the rules had sort of changed so that the getting of the ball was less decisive, and it was more about the level of force. And it did look like the attack was pretty nasty.
Yeah, I think so. I think, there's some skill in getting the ball, right? That's quite a key part of a tackle. But he went through, and his other leg didn't actually strike the leg. I wonder if it does, and contact is not the key here.
I don't like VAR. No, very few people do now, but I think one of its uses could be to address excessively harsh tackling.
It was like the one Calvert-Lewin and Fernandinho. That was absolutely appalling. Mm-hmm. Got a yellow, not reviewed, and still a yellow? Really? With the scissor movement? I mean, this is so dangerous. Anyway,
I thought that was going to be Philippe's first swear of 2020, but not, we'll leave that for the World Cup final in Manchester. So in the FA Cup, West Ham go to Gillingham, Bournemouth host Luton, and that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at the Amex. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly live shows, Barry. 20th of January, the Salus Benny Theatre in Brighton. Me, you, Ellis and Nikki. 27th and 28th, Liberty Hall in Dublin. I think there are a handful for each night. Then the 9th and 10th, we're coming to Scotland, Elliot.
Hey,
Glasgow University Debating Chambers on the 9th. On the 10th, we're at the Pleasance in Edinburgh. Lars coming for both
March,
nights.
March, isn't it?
That is March, yeah.
Yes.
What did I say?
Well, you didn't say
I didn't
you
say
just
a month.
Said 9th.
Turn up every 9th and 10th, and we'll be there for one of them. Lars for both nights. Other guests, TBC. So come along. They're fun, aren't they, Barry?
Yes, I enjoy them.
Are you going to pander to the Scottish listeners with a bumper edition of Fitback Corner?
Absolutely. We did. We were quite nervous because I read below the line on one of the recent pods.
But that was your first mistake.
Yeah, I know. But I quite like going there occasionally. Somebody who was angry with our Scottish football coverage suggested this was why the Scots wanted independence, because of how Barry and I had treated something in Fitbar, which I thought was quite the stretch.
It's a major factor.
It's a major factor. Anyway, I'd like you to stay with us, but listen, you know, I'm not sure. I got fully behind the Remain Alliance, and that went well, didn't it? Maybe I should keep quiet on these notes.
You don't know you're in Paris, Max.
Right, anyway, come along and see us. It'll be fun. Before we get on to the rest of yesterday's games, tonight is Liverpool v Sheffield United, the second most potent attack and the best team in the world versus the second most stingy defence. Does anyone think Sheffield United can take anything from Anfield? Anyone give them a hope?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
There's always hope.
Yeah, I'd give them a hope, actually. They're sort of the two best coach teams in the league, maybe.
Yeah.
Sheffield United and Liverpool, in very different ways. But Liverpool might be a bit tired. And Sheffield United don't give much away.
Let's go to the Amex. Brighton 1, Chelsea 1. Jahan Bash. What an overhead kick that is, Barry.
It's stunning. Just a wonderful feat of athleticism. And it just shows what a goal can do for your confidence, because I would imagine he had none before scoring his first for Brighton on it was Boxing Day. And then he didn't start yesterday, which I thought was kind of surprising, but he did come on and score that. I mean, it was just sensational.
Where on the overhead kick scale, on the Trevor Sinclair scale, as I call it, would you put this?
It's a great question, Max. I wanted to address this.
Great.
I think that there's an issue around overhead kicks in that because Trevor Sinclair sets the gold standard, understandably, goals like this tend to get a bit underrated. So there's obviously the sort of overhead thunder bastard, which is the Trevor Sinclair thing, the Rooney goal famously, although obviously Rooney shinned that.
Yeah.
But I think these kinds of goals where you get very high to get the overhead kick and then it kind of loops in and I think it should bounce before the line, I find those particularly pleasing. This goal reminded me of a goal that Ali McCoy scored against Hibs in the 1992 Skull Cup final.
I was thinking that too.
I'm sure you were. And McCoy had been injured all season and Rangers were totally out of luck. Chuck McCoist on with, I think, about 15 minutes left. And I think the great thing about overhead kicks like this is just as a kind of act of faith. You're sort of flinging yourself up in the air. And in all likelihood, it's going to go horribly wrong. But sometimes they just loop in.
So would you put this in a different category? Because the Sinclair Rooney ones are from a moving ball. That's why they're better, right? Or technically more difficult. It's harder to make contact with that. Would you separate these two?
I think there should be a lot more respect for overhead kicks, like the Ronaldo one, also another one that kind of flew in. People are kind of obsessed with a very clean contact. I quite like the ones where you get kind of maximum height and then it kind of slightly dribbles in.
Okay, no,
and
I'm happy with
the Gareth Bale one. Where would you put that
in the Champions League final? I was at my brother's wedding when that was scored, so I can't read.
I was in the stadium.
Do you have to factor in the occasion, though? Because doing it in a Champions League final, or indeed a Skull Cup final, you get extra points for that because it's
maybe
a final.
There are extra points as well for this one, for Jahan Bash. I think because of the elegance and the handsomeness of the player.
Very
as well.
Handsome.
And also the angle at which he takes the ball.
Yeah.
When it is right over your head, it's not quite as beautiful when you're on the side. It looks
you become a scissor kick.
Yes.
Like Haller's was, in scissor kick trajectory as opposed to overhead kick, I would
it
say.
It loops very pleasingly over all the Chelsea players who all just have to stand there and watch.
And they had time to turn around and have a look.
And feel really sad.
Yeah, I totally feel this. Yeah, I mean, I was in the stadium for the Bale overhead kick. Oh. And there was an audible silence before people cheered because it was so extraordinary. Although there was also an audible silence when Karius threw the ball at Benzema goal as well.
We should also mention the amazing footage of the three Brighton fans looking absolutely amazed in their puffer jackets.
Yeah, that was tremendous, wasn't it? Chelsea were better in the first half, battered in the second. Kepa made some brilliant saves as well. Again, dropping points against a, inverted commas, lesser team, Philippe. What do you
think? Well, because I wouldn't put Brighton as a lesser team to start with. They've been impressive all through the season. Obviously, a team that is extremely... I mean, what I like about it is that they actually play simple football, but with an awful lot of intelligence and desire and obviously full commitment to what their manager is wants them to do. And I was more impressed by the way that Brighton stayed in the game when I thought, actually, this is looking a bit, Chelsea away from home have been terrific most of the season. But the way they reacted, I would put that down to Brighton being, a very good team indeed.
Yeah, because Brighton were getting overrun in midfield for the first half hour and then...
Well, they had the kind of diamond, which...
Yeah, it wasn't working. Graham Potter switched to five across the middle, was it? And then at half time, took off a midfielder and brought on another striker. So it was brave from him to chase the game, and it worked.
Andy says, other than Aaron Moy, the GOAT, who's your favourite Australian to play in the Premier League?
Mark Viduka?
I think I'm in the Viduka camp as well.
Tim Cahill? Good celebration.
Yeah, true. But then he changed his celebration because he was sponsored by an airline once.
Kewell had some magnificent moments. Yeah.
I'm going to go left field with Stan Lazaridis.
I knew you'd do that.
Yes. Who was the guy who played for Wolves who was very violent?
Kevin Muscat.
That's the guy.
I did a TV show with him in Australia, and he's a lovely man. He was a lovely man.
Yeah, and right. Right.
Here's the thing. We were getting on famously, and then there was someone took a penalty in a game where they looked the other way and spun and took the penalty. And I said to the panel, is anyone else? And Paul Oaken was on the panel as well. So any of you taken a penalty like that? And someone said, oh, you know, Kev hasn't taken many penalties. Or he'd taken one penalty. He wouldn't take it like that. And I said, well, would you two-foot it? And he didn't look very he didn't look very happy when I said that.
Like the kind of player who'd sharpen his studs.
Yeah. But look, he was a nice chap to sit next to. FA Cup, Brighton play Sheffield Wednesday. Oh, no, I do want to mention the ball popped in the 89th minute, and that is a cracking bit of Sunday league in the Premier League. I really, really enjoyed it. All the players waving. You're like, why are they waving? And the ball was completely flat. Really enjoyed that. Brighton play Sheffield Wednesday. Chelsea home to Forest in the FA Cup. Watford won again. They beat Wolves 2-1. Another win for Nigel Pearson. They won 10 of their 19 points in the last four games. Just 2 points off safety now. Both sides had good chances before De La Feo gave Watford the lead. A lovely finish. He's an interesting player. I'm sort of drawn to watching De La Feo, Philippe, and often thinking, why is he only at Watford, with all due respect to Watford?
Because the player you see at the moment is not the player you might see next week or in 2 weeks' time or a month's time. He's incredibly inconsistent. He's perceived as being a player who doesn't put in a shift as well, all these sort of things. Yeah, a luxury player, basically. So, but when it's working as it is at the moment, is an absolute joy to watch.
Same thing
as is Watford, to be honest, at the moment.
Same thing for Doucouré, who, as far as I can tell, every window gets linked to... Not just a big club, but links to sort of Real Madrid or Barcelona. There's always someone huge who wants Doucouré.
Well, for me, he's when you see, for example, what happened to a player like Steven Nzonzi, who we put about the same class and who went to La Liga and so forth, became a French international. I think Doucouré is actually more talented. And that even when the team was not doing well at all, he's technically so accomplished. He's also an incredibly smart footballer, whom, yes, I'm surprised that he hasn't been picked on by a bigger club.
There's a lot of bigger teams who seem to have quite big holes in their midfield, and you can see Doucouré slotting in quite nicely.
And Nigel Pearson just doing a fantastic job, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he is.
We salute you, Nigel. Happy?
Well, just you keep doing this to me. You make a completely blindingly obvious statement. Look at me, and I go, yeah.
All right. It's the calmness of Pearson. The moment he arrived, as I said, whatever happens, it'll be fine. So he has this composure about him. When they lost their first game with him, did he complain about anything? Not at all. Was happy with the performance, carried on. It's like he's not getting carried away by anything. Mm. And it's blindingly obvious, basically. And I've read somewhere that the media sort of had criticised Watford for picking him in the first place. I don't remember that happening at all. I think most people would have admitted that he was actually a very sound choice given the state that the club was in.
I think, obviously, it just gave everyone a chance to talk about that ostrich press conference, which we enjoyed because it was something fantastic. Slightly different in a press conference. But yeah, he did a great job, didn't he, with Leicester, and got them out of a hole, didn't he?
Well, he also got them into the hole. So.
That is true. Mm. Yeah. Much like Hasenhüttl, he can be criticised for getting them in the hole and then congratulated for getting them out of the hole.
I'm sure we could say something about ostriches and holes in the ground. I don't know. I can't remember.
Deflected one for Neto, the best supermarket currently playing in the Premier League since Clinton Morrison. Yellow for Cabasele for pulling Diego Jota down. VAR changed it to a red. Was that right?
I thought it was a bit harsh, but I might have been swayed by how sad Cabasele seemed when he got the red card.
Well, he did the classic sort of laughing as if it wasn't even a free kick. You know, players go so... I think Kovacic did this a couple of times for Chelsea where he got booked for, you know, a tactical foul. And the first thing, when they blow the free kick, they think, well, if I laugh as if this shouldn't even be a free kick, the referee might not book me in a sort of really playground.
He was sent off in a lighthearted way instead.
Exactly. Watford play Tranmere, Wolves play Man United. Philippe?
Just one thing about this sending off. I was a little bit, when I saw it, I thought, again, is it clear and obvious? Not at all, because there is actually another player who is in the covering position. So you're making a judgment not on what is happening, but on the capacity of the other player to sprint fast enough to catch up with Jota. So you think, well, that's really a load of ifs and buts. So perhaps in doubt, especially it was not a violent foul or anything like that, maybe yellow would have been.
True, although...
Or a black card.
Yeah, a sin bin.
The black card.
Okay. The tricky thing there is a still footage of a player 5 yards away. That's still quite a lot of distance to cover, isn't it? If you're running at pace, he would have just probably been just behind him.
Maybe we'll see VAR change the way those decisions are made, because if the decision's being made by a linesman or an assistant referee, then they're going to be judging it sort of in two dimensions, if you like. So the covering player you'll get the credit for that as the person who commits the foul. Whereas on VAR, you can make some kind of judgment, at least on that distance.
Burnley 1, Aston Villa 2, huge win for Villa, who've generally done quite well against teams in the bottom half. Just 1 point in 10 games against teams in the top half, though. Jack Grealish was immense, wasn't he? Scored one with a glorious finish where everyone thought he was going to put it in the other corner. Set up Wesley's. Without making a blindingly obvious statement to you, Barry, Grealish is a wonderful footballer.
Yeah. I was surprised a bit. Maybe that he stayed at Villa this season. He's been linked with bigger clubs for quite some time, and it's quite obvious he's good enough to play for them. He seems a very well-rounded individual. I mean, I know he's had issues in the past with his off-field activities, but he was just a kid at the time. And he's maturing into a wonderful footballer and what seems like a really, really nice man who you would suggest would be an asset to any team. He clearly has a great love for Villa, and I mean, they suffered two what looked quite bad injuries yesterday to Tom Heaton and
to Wesley as well.
Wesley.
Yeah.
And that could have serious implications for their attempts to stay up, depending on what the outcome is once they've had their scans and whatnot. But I would fear the worst, particularly in the case of Wesley. But if they can't keep Jack Grealish fit, you'd say they're probably doomed.
I thought that was a terrible tackle on Wesley, and I was surprised that the referee didn't take more action.
Wesley was, before that terrible injury, part of perhaps the best bit of VAR so far this season, the heel of Wesley. Warren Horton, journalist writing, Stephen Warnock calls it good Burnley defending, and his heel should have been up with play. commentary is sometimes hard, right? Are Wesley's feet too big? Matt says Georgie Hadji would be worth even more with VAR about. I think he had a size 5 boot.
The thing is, you can't reduce the size of your heel.
No, that is, it is too big. The big-heeled Wesley. Next few
the
games,
well-heeled.
Yeah, the well-heeled. Well, let's hope so. And the next few games could be crucial for Villa, at home to City on the 12th. Then they've got Brighton away, Watford at home, and away to Bournemouth. Burnley did fight back, missed a few chances. Chris Wood's goal was their first effort on target. Daniel Story writing, Burnley have only had 10 shots on target since the end of November. Richard says, you should have been at Turf Moor, Max. If you didn't hate Burnley before that first half non-showing, you will now. I hate them, and I've been a season ticket holder for about 30 years. But 10 shots on target since the end of November, is that's sad, isn't it?
Thanks, Max.
Great kit from Villa as well. I think it's worth mentioning Villa's kit.
Talk us through it.
It's sort of a very odd shade of green with black sleeves and black shorts and then sort of red letters on it. They look like they've been put through some kind of Photoshop, but they're just there on the pitch.
Okay, yeah, I'm normally quite anti-green kits. I was very, I'm deep hatred of Wolves away kit. Almost can't see him if you're not concentrating. It's so pitch coloured.
Green kit. I mean, that's Saint-Etienne, one of the most glorious kits in history.
I know. I've incurred the wrath of Saint-Etienne fans before on this subject. Not something I thought I'd ever do, to be honest.
You might not want to rail too much against green kits when you're in Glasgow, Max.
That's a very good point. Burnley play Peterborough in the FA Cup, and Villa go to Fulham. To the Etihad, City 2, Everton 1. Foden had one in the net early. VAR in the build-up said it was offside.
It was offside. Yeah, it was clearly visibly offside with the net. You didn't need the benefit of, the rock and roll and the lines. Mm.
The next one, though, Mahrez going through, flagged offside, brought down, no penalty, definitely didn't look offside. They just went, it's offside, because that means you don't have to give the penalty. I didn't quite...
Well, I was confused by that. Like everyone in the stadium, I wasn't sure what was going on. But... they were checking to see if it should have been a penalty, but the whistle had been blown for offside before he was brought down. I thought it was a penalty, to be honest. I thought he was fouled after the whistle had gone, but because he was pulled back. But it was, again, a ludicrous state of affairs where nobody in the stadium really knew what was happening. And if they had awarded a penalty, there would have been absolute outrage.
I mean, I quite enjoyed City fans not celebrating until Everton actually kicked off after Gabriel Jesus scored the opener in the second half. His first touch for that goal was beautiful.
Yeah.
He's got the second, hit the post late on. Who would you pick, Philippe, him or Aguero? Aguero 14, Jesus 13 in all competitions.
Aguero, I think, without a doubt. Without a doubt. In the bigger games, I mean, don't think there's any... I mean, is there a debate even?
I don't know. I feel Jesus is getting closer, right?
It was an interesting formation, by the way, by Ancelotti. I mean, when I looked at it, I thought, he's playing seven at the back or something. But it actually worked quite well, I thought, for quite long periods of play.
Was Sigurdsson in midfield again?
Yeah. He had a very quiet game, though. He was taken off. I was quite impressed with Everton, but yeah. Ancelotti was repeatedly on the sideline, sort of urging them to get forward and stop playing sideways passes and passes back towards their own goal. And the players seemed strangely reluctant to do that. But, you know, they were still in it up to the end and could conceivably have nicked a point.
Yeah, Moise Keane had that scissor kick, didn't he, right at the end? If we're getting our overheads and our scissors, he was sort of right on the cusp. Quite liked Everton in darker blue, actually.
Great kit.
It was a really nice kit. And
it also hides the Angry Birds logo really well. You can barely see it.
And nice to see the contrast of Pep, trendy bomber, hipster trousers, Ancelotti, just bringing so much style.
So much tailoring.
So much tailoring to the dugout, wasn't it?
And you know, Dunk behind him.
Yeah.
No tailoring at all.
No, I know. As we established last pod, they are an unlikely detective duo that have been thrust together, you know, either in Naples or in Glasgow. And one of them is struggling to come to terms with their new environment and the other one is showing them the ropes.
It's Big Dunk's job to lean over and say, Carlo, there's been a murder.
City play Port Vale. Liverpool Everton in the FA Cup. Yeah. Oh, that's a good one, isn't it? Right, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin at St James's Park. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Newcastle 0, Leicester City 3. Let us marvel at the Hamza Chowdhury goal. Tom Williams writing, that goal is the goal that Alan Shearer's goal against Holland at Euro 96 became when it grew up. And that's a lovely description of their beautiful layoff and just a wonderful side foot pass. For me, the best goal of the day. Does anybody want to take issue? So I'm putting that above Jahanbash.
I thought Jahanbash's was slightly better, but they were both excellent goals. Why do we have to have a best one? Can we not just enjoy them both?
I thought you were super zen coming back from India, but already. I've hit a nerve. Can't I have a better one?
Barry, you're going to be judging goal of the decade for the next 10 years.
It had so much, though. It comes off the bar. It's a side foot pass. It's his first goal.
It's also at St James's Park. I think goals often look better at St James's Park. Good camera angle.
That's a good one.
Yeah. We think about Bergkamp's goal, for example.
True.
A lot of Shearer's goal. I mean, Shearer obviously scored a lot there.
Yeah. Maybe that's a good point. Because sometimes great goals in League Two, when you're watching them on Quest, they just don't quite have the same feel, do they? I thought it was a total delight.
I think you're either getting, as well as the camera angle, you're either getting, 60,000 exultant Geordies or just like total dejection.
Does anyone think Florian Lejeune went out on New Year's Eve?
God, he had a mare, didn't he? He was directly responsible for the first two goals. And yeah, just had one of those days. But Newcastle, Steve Bruce, fans weren't happy when he was appointed. I think they were beginning to warm to him a bit. And now they've had this disastrous Christmas. Now, they deserve, well, do they? Because they were already 2-0 down. But they had four players go off with injuries yesterday. I think Steve Bruce has 15 of his squad unavailable for the cup. That's going to be problematic for them. And they will need to invest in January.
Yeah. Madison with a belter. I mean, after Lejeune's second mistake.
I think Madison's goal was better than Chowdhury's.
Wow.
Was it goal of the decade?
Right. Why can't we enjoy all of them, Barry?
I did enjoy them.
Yeah. Leicester versus the rest of the top five. 1 point in five games. Leicester versus the bottom 15. They've only dropped 4 points in 16 games.
Yeah, that's the Manchester United way of doing well in the league, that to absolutely steamroll everything that's behind you. One thing about this this spate of injuries at Newcastle, I mean, because we've actually mentioned loads of injuries since the beginning of this pod, and I think that honestly, it just shows that what we've just lived through, even though it was extremely enjoyable, is totally crazy, insane, and should be stopped, because we're actually playing more football now in 2019, 2020, in the festive period, than we have played at any point since league began in 1888.
That's a fact. Oh, really? People, because you keep hearing people saying, people used to say, play Christmas Day and Boxing Day.
Yeah, yes, that's very true. They used to play Christmas Day, Boxing Day, generally a derby, when players were covering 7 to 8 kilometres per game. But what people forget is that they were not playing like a week before Christmas Day, and very often they only played again on the 2nd or 3rd of January. So there was, in this period, yes, there were two games in 2 days, but that was that.
But
now we have 4 games in 10 days, which is totally insane.
I agree, it takes its toll, but
it's great fun for us, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It is great fun, but like at Arsenal last night, for example, I thought the second half the players were almost just too tired on both sides to really
I think the football hasn't been that great.
You get mistakes, you get players miles out of position.
And when you've got so many great goals, generally it's a sign that players are not closing in quickly enough on other players, so you've got more space, more time. Therefore, you're able to perform very difficult tricks, technical bits and so forth, which don't require necessarily a great deal of physicality. And we've seen, I mean, yesterday was actually, the number of great goals we had was wonderful.
Joe Linton didn't get any of them. He missed a one-on-one at 0-0. And on a day when Haller and Wesley scored, very sad for him to be the only miscuing big new target man who can't buy a goal. Rumour that Spurs want Pereira from Leicester. Why would you go?
If you're Pereira.
Yeah.
I guess you'd get Champions League, although you probably get Champions League with Leicester next season. Anyway, he is an absolutely brilliant player, and maybe a bit underrated in terms of Leicester's quality, I think.
Not any longer.
Right.
Not any longer.
Rochdale hosts Newcastle. Leicester play Wigan in the FA Cup. Takaro Road. Norwich won. Crystal Palace won. Norwich had so many chances to increase their lead in the second half.
Been a huge problem for them. Friend of the show, Melissa Rudd, was tweeting after the game, which I'm fairly sure she was at it, that in their past 5 home games, Norwich have been leading at half time by 1-0. And they've failed to increase the lead, and they've failed to win any of those 5 games. And she's putting it all down to really poor game management.
You know, and there's a lot of ifs and buts in there.
Yeah, there are a lot of ifs and buts.
But, you know, 8 points in the 16 games since they beat City, 5 points adrift at the bottom, 7 points from safety. I still feel that they are good enough to rescue it. I suppose their only issue is there aren't 3 teams in meltdown. There are 2. You know, there's Burnley and Bournemouth, but there isn't another one.
I have a feeling Newcastle could find themselves in meltdown very quickly, particularly with all these injuries. But it also, you have to factor in, what are these clubs going to do during the January window? I think teams generally go into it with great intentions and end up not doing much. There aren't generally huge amounts of activity in the January window.
No, you're right. Quite often it's Sky Sports News.
Tumbleweed.
A lot of loans.
Yeah. And nothing happened. I did a 3-hour show where the only thing happened was Graham Dorans went somewhere. The Graham Dorans special on deadline day. Your favourite, Conor Wickham, scored a goal though, Barry?
Yeah, which was nearly chalked off. Nice to see him back amongst the goals. He's had an awful time of injuries. I don't know if he's good enough to play in the Premier League, but
Ex-Ipswich.
So that would upset people. It was a great opportunity for a commentator to say, that's VAR at its best. Brandon Pierrick came on for Palace at the end, becoming their second youngest Premier League debutant, born on the 10th of December, 2001. Number one on that day, Got to Get Through This by Daniel Bedingfield. Matthew says, with no really bad teams adrift this season, how many points do you think will be needed for survival this year? You think it, you will need 40?
If not more, actually.
Wow.
42, perhaps.
Who are the sides that have... Sheffield United went down.
West Ham went down with 42 or 43 when Trevor Brooking was the caretaker manager, I think.
All right. Preston play Norwich, Palace host Derby. Lee says, is the BT Sport all-dayer and Amazon Prime watch whatever game you like the future of live broadcasting football? Should it be embraced or seen as a threat to crowd numbers across the league, Spaz?
I don't see it as a threat to crowd numbers across the league. Just on both those days, I think I watched three games yesterday and Match of the Day. And on Amazon Prime Day, I watched four games. And I found myself struggling to remember what happened in which game. And I don't know if it's the future.
I think fans want choice, probably, want to watch their team. That's great. For the small number of podcast hosts and contributors, it's a bloody nightmare.
I think fans would probably also quite like to choose to pay for one package rather than three or four or six or whatever. Yeah.
But what I wonder is, I have an interest in Spurs in the Premier League, but not a desperation to, you know, I don't need to watch every single game they play, is I like the idea of not actually having a complete choice and going, oh, this is the game. Oh, I want to watch that game, and sitting down and going, this is an event. Whereas if you can watch every game, and if, you know, I was watching, what were the first two games? I started watching Brighton-Chelsea and then thought, actually, you know, Burnley-Villa might be more interesting. And then you don't actually watch a whole football match.
And it also precipitates a kind of atomization of the audience, as in everybody's watching something different. Whereas, you know, if you're, oh, this is the big game on the Saturday, even, you know, Saturday 5:30 or Sunday 4:30 or whatever it is, this is the big game. No, suddenly you can watch whatever you want, anytime you want. So it is atomization yet again. On the other hand, I don't think how you're going to escape that, because this is the equivalent of Spotify for football, basically.
The top two met in the Championship. West Brom and Leeds drew 1-1. On that note, I watched the first 15 minutes of that and then moved away. West Brom's goal was scored by Semi Ajay, who later scored an own goal to level it up. They stay on 52 points, 9 clear of Brentford in third, who won 4-0 at Bristol City. Millwall beat Luton 3-1, just as well as at 1-0 down. Their defender, Jake Cooper, pretty much cleared his own shot off the line from a free kick. It's an amazing miss. Huddersfield went down 5-2 at home to Stoke, a game which was paused for a message to be played over the PA after James McLean was targeted with abusive chanting. Hull won 1-0 at Sheffield Wednesday. George says, how would Barry cope with having to park 10 minutes away and not being able to play music before the podcast? This after Hull boss Grant McCann claimed that Sheffield Wednesday made him park 10 minutes away from Hillsborough and then turned off the electricity plugs in the visitors' changing room so that they couldn't play their pre-game music. Sounds very John Beck to me.
Wow.
That seems quite shithousery before the game's even started.
Extraordinary.
In League One, Wickham are still top, despite going without a win in four. They drew 1-1 at home with Ipswich, themselves a fifth, but without a win in eight. Rotherham and Coventry both won to leapfrog Oxford, who lost 1-0 at Doncaster, dropped down to fourth. In League Two, the top four all won. Swindon stay top with a semi-local rivalry win over Plymouth. Exeter stay second with a semi-local rivalry win over Forest Green Rovers. Nicky Maynard scored a hat-trick as Mansfield beat Cambridge. Nicky Maynard must be 1,000 now. Ian Holloway's back in management, taking over at Grimsby. He was watching from the stands as they beat Salford 1-0. He tweeted, what a day, what a start. Thanks to all the Grimsby supporters who turned up today, got right behind the lads. Still plenty of work ahead, but it's a fantastic feeling to be up and running. Apparently, part of the interview process took place at Papa's Fish and Chips restaurant in Cleethorpes. Elliot, in 1 minute, tell us what Football is a Country is, please, your podcast.
Oh, it's my podcast that I started with a couple of friends, Kareem and Phil, last year. We did a couple pilot episodes and we're going to be relaunching later this month. It's a sort of occasional, semi-frequent podcast about the politics and culture of football, a sort of sideways look at things, generally kind of topic-driven rather than sort of rounding up results and stuff.
So the perfect complement to Football Weekly.
Exactly.
Oh, marvellous. Philippe, here is a tweet. Back from Baba Goal. First title in club history. First club in the world to win a title in 2020. First title for Podolski, Iniesta, Sergi and Villa in Japan. Last game and title in David Villa's career. Congrats to Vissel Kobe.
That's a and way Thomas to open Vermeulen.
And Thomas Vermaelen as well.
He plays there as well, yeah. First trophy in 54 years for Vissel Kobe.
Yeah, good for them. Peter says, in 1973, I went to a half-empty Wembley for a celebration friendly, the 3 versus the 6, to mark our entry into the EU. The Germans dominated Europe with Netzer, Müller and Beckenbauer. We won 2-0. A Dane scored. Should there now be a 1 versus the 27 as we leave? It'd be a tough game.
That's extraordinary. This one, the 3 versus the 6.
Yeah, apparently so.
Wow.
And Joe says, which Premier League manager would be the best at yelling out the scores in darts?
Sean Dyche. End of story.
I fear that with all these questions, the answer is always Sean Dyche. 92. Peter, you require 158. Listen, that'll do for today. Thanks so much for your time. Thank you, Elliot, and I'll see you again.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Philippe.
Well, thank you very much. I didn't have a chance to rant about the World Cup in Manchester.
Oh, yeah.
Well, never mind. That will be for another time.
You can do it another time. Yes. Cheers, Barry.
Yeah, thanks.
We'll be back on Thursday. Thursday?
No, Monday.
Is it Thursday today?
Yeah.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.